meant to sharpen your questions and sharpen your wits on phrasing your question laconically so that he and I may understand what you are driving at and be quite blunt. Some of the questions in the past have been rather rambling, and I'm afraid that I have eliminated some of those even before reading them carefully, and some others I couldn't read because they were so poorly written. So if you'd like to have your question read, try to write it a little better. All right? Oh, here's it. Beautiful Palmer method. Mr. Abrams, you say that housing restrictions are not entirely the fault of the white man, but that government is partly to blame. Aren't the two practically synonymous, since whites are in the majority in our country?
I never like to condemn a whole race, you see. This applies to the white man as well as the Negro. And when you say that it's the fault of the white man, the implication in the question is that a whole group is apparently in the wrong. People act because there's an environment or a set of circumstances which make them act that way. There was a time in this country when Negroes and whites lived in the same general areas. There were Negro pockets practically all over New York City and all over Brooklyn, and there was no fear. It isn't a question of the fault of the white man. The white man was not at fault. There was no problem at the time. What has happened is that certain fears have been aroused. Fear and fault are two different things. The fear of loss of social status, the fear of loss of neighborhood associations, the fear of loss of the value of the school, the fear of loss of real estate values have set in largely because of this in-migration of a population which, if distributed throughout the metropolitan area, and if the program which I mentioned allowed that distribution, there would be no problem and no fault of the white man, no fault of anybody. I think, therefore, that when we try to blame anybody, we have to try to create an environment in which people will function normally. And when they function normally and without fear, I don't think there'll be any question about trying to pick a defendant and impugning him on the ground that he's evil or that he's to blame, and that if he were out of the picture, there would be no problem for the Negro or for anybody else. I would say this. When you talk about the fault of the government, I definitely say yes. Because government, since 1935, has had the power to create and manipulate environment in which the element of fault functions. And when government itself, which has the power to create and manipulate and supervise the actions of other people, takes no affirmative action to dispel the fears, or to create an environment in which people can live without tensions, and deliberately, in fact, does the opposite, then I say the government is at fault, or rather the government was at fault up to about 1950, definitely, and to some extent even today, because I don't think the government has as yet acted fully to dispel these fears or to help create a workable environment.
Would you comment on the phenomenon, especially in California, of efforts to repeal fair housing laws?
I think the reformers there made a mistake. This is what I'm referring to. I think we lost the Berkeley statute because they put in a provision there to the effect that it is a misdemeanor to violate the non-discrimination law, the residence law. Now, I believe that laws have an educative function, particularly civil rights laws. They create a climate. The law sets down the ethic of the community. But I think that when you try to impose a penalty suddenly upon a group for discriminating, a very sharp penalty, I think that you lose the fight. In each case, and this has been my experience in New York State, in each case you try to make advances which can be absorbed, which are workable, which are practical. I think it's foolish to try to go ahead and, advance in for the social reformer to advance in chaos while the bigot is retreating in good order. I think that that there's an obligation to be practical, and I think that it was this effort to impose what is a criminal penalty suddenly upon a community that wasn't ready for it that lost some of the people who were generally in favor of such a law.
Since the majority of Negroes and Puerto Ricans are at the bottom of the economic ladder and are the principal occupants of public housing, are we not therefore perpetuating ghettos with public housing?
The answer is yes. I think that if you have 100% Negroes in a project, and here government has the power of tenant selection and creates it, that you necessarily get segregated schools. I had this question when I was chairman of the New York City House, chairman of the State Commission Against Discrimination, presented me to me, and I had to hand down a written opinion. I did. It's called Miles Against the New York City Housing Authority. And it concerned white lady married to a Negro husband who complained that the housing authority was relegating them to a Negro project. I went in and examined very thoroughly all of the practices of the housing authority and interviewed their members. And apparently what had happened was that the housing authority was trying to break the Negro segregation pattern in public housing and was trying to do it in good faith. And what was it trying to do? When applications came in, they were trying to distribute these applications so that they'd get more integration within the neighborhoods. After examining the facts and talking to many of the employees, I found out that for many years the Housing Authority did have, actually was looking at color in order to make the tenant selection. But that under their most recent chairman and vice chairman, they were really trying to desegregate some of the public housing. It was a tough question to decide because you have a clash of two principles. One principle says that you must be colorblind when you're a public agency. Another principle says that segregation is discrimination, causes segregated schools, and that therefore it is the duty of the public agency to prevent segregation. Now, how can you prevent segregation while being colorblind? You don't know. I mean, you've got to look at color. It's a very tough problem, and of course, there's never a serious problem in having to decide on one principle, but when you get a clash of two principles, then you're really in trouble. I came to the conclusion, based upon the logic in a case against which involved discrimination against the Chinese, Ye Kuo against Hopkins, a California case in about 1880, in which what was involved was a perfectly valid ordinance barring wooden laundries in San Francisco. This was certainly a fire prevention problem, a fire prevention aim. But the court nevertheless struck down the statute as the ordinance as unconstitutional on the ground that the motive in passing that statute was to eliminate the Chinese, keep them from making a livelihood, and therefore struck the law down as constitutional. I came to the conclusion that where you have that motivation in these cases, where you have clashes of principle, fire prevention versus protection of people against discrimination, where you have a clash of two principles, in this case, colorblindness, prevention of segregation, that good faith is the only way, the only factor on which you can make a determination. And if the housing authority was trying at that time to prevent segregation in a situation in which segregation was almost automatically being forced on them, that if their motive was good, that I, as the chairman of one discrimination, one public agency, would not interfere with their managerial discretion. I would interfere only when I thought that the motive was not to find a solution. Now, I don't like percentages. I like colorblindness. But you have a situation, when you're faced with a situation in which colorblindness gives you segregation, you have a temporary situation which you've got to deal with practically. In public housing, I think you can deal with it practically, first by educating white tenants, second by the proper site selection. If you select the site in a Negro area, you're going to get all Negroes. If you select it in a white area, you'll get fewer Negroes. If you select it in a border area, you'll get more Negroes. Where you put your renting office also determines, if you put it on the white side or on the Negro side, also determines how many whites you will get. If you increase incomes, if you don't throw people out of public housing projects when they've increased their incomes, and white income increases faster than Negro income, then you'll have more whites. In other words, there are techniques, general policies, which you can set without looking at the color of an individual. And I think if those policies are set, you can still maintain the colorblind doctrine. But if, despite this, you cannot maintain it, and if the housing authority is trying to maintain it otherwise, I would not interfere with it.
This person says, I'm all for fair housing, but isn't it true if I had a home and a Negro family moved in next door, the property of my land would drop? The property value of my land would drop, I suppose he meant. What can be done to prevent this drop in the value of my home?
I wouldn't assume right away that the property value would drop. If that was your only consideration, I might say it might even rise. It depends. I framed out about eight different situations in which property would be affected. It might rise, it might go down, it might stand still. It might stand still for a moment and then go up. Properties rise or fall depending upon the state of the market. If as a result of a Negro moving in, other Mrs. Grundy passes the word around that the section is going down in social status, and other people move out suddenly, the market becomes glutted and values go down. It's very much like a run on a bank. If you will say tomorrow that a certain bank is insolvent, it will become insolvent. If you say that it brings down values, you will spark fears in other people, and it will bring down values. On the other hand, there have been sections that I've seen all around the country, including the South, where Negroes live next door to whites, where they've lived in the same area for years without affecting values, without disturbing social status. I think it's a question of it's a question of stabilizing the community. And this is why, actually, I've been trying to find formulae for distributing people as widely as possible. You're less apt to fear the drop in values on the property, if indeed there will be a drop, if the situation is metropolitan-wide. This was the situation that existed in the United States. I mean, the rich person had to live near the poor person because the poor person had to service him. And the fact that he lived on the next block didn't make a darn bit of difference as far as values were concerned, despite the fact that he was an East European. Why? Because the people had security, not because of the presence of another group nearby. You have an abnormal situation today in which the fears are sparked. And the thing that we've got to do, and this is one of the important techniques we've got to develop, is how to allay those fears. I think you can allay them by opening up housing everywhere. If you simply force one person and not others to do it, then all of the applications are going to come into that one landlord. And indeed, his house will become entirely Negro-occupied. If, however, you pass a law and the administration enforces it sincerely and acts against everybody, I think that fear ultimately will subside. Look what happened in New York City. Everybody feared this law would destroy values. What has it done to values? Why? Because it's enforced properly. It hasn't affected values at all. It hasn't caused any great inundations. And yet a question like this can be asked when we sit here right in the city of New York where we've gone through it for years and nothing has happened to the values.
If a white tenant wishes to integrate the apartment building in which he lives, how should he go about this?
By integrating it. I mean, is it New York City? You have to. I mean, if a Negro applicant comes in, you have to take the Negro applicant if he is financially solvent and if you have no other objection to him.
If a
white tenant
wishes to integrate the apartment building in which he lives, how should he go about this? And you're saying that there's a law.
Oh, well, the law doesn't apply to a white tenant. Oh, I see. It would apply to a landlord. But if a white tenant wishes to do it, I think it's really up to the landlord who's got a law. I don't know what the tenant in this case... apparently is, unless you have a... What you may be referring to is that you think that the landlord in this case is discriminating. He's violating the law. If you think that he's violating the law deliberately, then I think you can go down to the Attorney General who can file a complaint. you can file a complaint without a without an actual applicant. The question may imply a series of situations.
Fair housing laws operate on the basis of equal financial ability, which permits open occupancy for a minority of Negroes, but not for the majority who lack the financial ability. What other program elements, in addition to rent subsidies and lower mortgage rates, can you suggest?
That's a tough one. It's going to be tough even to put through the other two. For example, it'd be very difficult to get the suburbs to set up public agencies that will be non-discriminating. And therefore, when I advocated home ownership, I kind of did that deliberately because I thought that you might get this more certainly through private builders who would be given special FHA insurance or special subsidies by the federal government in an effort to bring this about in the suburban areas. You might get it through private builders or possibly through nonprofit corporations that are forming now around the country who will undertake to build. I think, for instance, outside of the East, the problem of developing new towns is now in high focus. The present federal administration has advocated 75% FHA insurance for land and utilities in order to encourage towns composed of 3,000 acres. All of these new towns that will be built, if that law is passed, will be subject to the non-discrimination executive order and therefore will have people of all walks of life and colors. I think that's a possibility. That is, if the government buys the land, plans it, retains the schools, the streets, and the public facilities, and then sells the subdivided land to private builders, as I advocated in the California report, that this is a formula for integrating the population and the income levels. Unfortunately, the federal government didn't go for this plan, but they did go for the FHA plan under which the initiative for buying land would be taken by the individual subdividers themselves. I don't particularly like that, but I haven't opposed it publicly. As far as rent, other elements in addition to rent subsidies and lower mortgage rates, I would advocate a much stronger, much more sincere administration of the President's Committee on Equal Opportunity in Housing. I don't think that it's done its job as yet. I think it's way behind it's what we expected to be the leadership in this issue. I would also curtail urban renewal, which displaces so many Negroes. All of these things, plus the family subsidies and the lower mortgage rates. In other words, I think if you want to overcome this problem as well as solve the housing problem, you have to have a series of programs which include not only lower mortgage rates and home ownership, but subsidies to families, new towns, better enforcement of the anti-discrimination laws, and also, above all, an education program that is meaningful.
Aren't some banks helping low-income home building at this time?
Very difficult to say. A bank is not an eleemosynary institution. A bank has to take a secure loan and get as high an interest rate as will not violate the usury law. The fact of the matter is that mortgage interest and amortization are the main elements in cost. They account for about 52% of the cost of the upkeep charges, the monthly upkeep charges of a home. And the house can't be built for less than about $12,000, $14,000, $15,000, $16,000, a new house. And I doubt very much that any Negro family or any poor family, considering the fact that about the 50% of the population have incomes below $6,000 a year, that any of these families, particularly the family earning $3,000 a year, can afford a decent house, or that the bank can afford to make a loan which it will consider safe. The bank should make a loan, I think, if the interest was subsidized, which is what I've been advocating. They are helping to some extent in making loans for repairs, but I don't think that they can help. They're not in a position to help, except possibly by making loans to Negro families instead of discriminating against them as they've done so often in the past.
In that connection, is anything being done to help the Negro and Puerto Rican family find adequate housing outside of the ghetto?
If you're talking nationally, if this question is being addressed as applying to the country as a whole, I would say that the only effort that is being made to help the minorities is after they're being kicked out in slum clearance undertakings. Then you have the city, the Urban Renewal Authority, scampering about after this family has gotten an average of $70, outside of New York City, of course, where they pay them more in New York City. They try to find them decent housing. I don't think they do. I think they kick them out let them find whatever housing they can in many cases. In other cases, they may put them into public housing in about one-fifth of the cases. But in most cases, these people have to fend for themselves. There are, as a result of the Urban Renewal Program, these efforts around the country to try to find them housing. They try to find housing in the ghetto, out of the ghetto, but I don't think that it's a service to these people. As far as New York is concerned, if you're addressing the question to New York, there is virtually no agency trying to find adequate housing outside of the ghetto for one simple reason, and that is that there isn't any for people of low income. We're suffering the strictures of housing shortage. We have a rent control law which expresses the fact that there's a housing shortage. While there's a vacancy rate in the apartments at $60 a room, there is virtually no vacancy rate in the areas in which, particularly outside the ghetto areas of New York, of New York City. And even if there was an agency trying to find you housing, I think they'd have great difficulty doing so. Theoretically, there is one agency attached to the city, headed by Mr. Badillo, I think, which is, as in other parts of the United States, trying to find housing for people who are being displaced by urban renewal. There is an 8% turnover of housing in New York due to death, migration, and other things. You always have a turnover, despite the fact that you might have a 0% vacancy. And by offering the landlord a little more to take in the tenant who is being put out, offering the broker a bonus, you might preempt one of these apartments for some of these displaced families. But I think it's a chaotic situation. In my opinion, slum demolition, except where absolutely necessary, ought to be curtailed until you've solved the housing problem and created a vacancy rate in which people could have a greater freedom of choice.
Well, this sort of connects up with that. How do you feel about the possibility of abolishing rent control?
To me, rent control was never a reform. It was a hold-the-line operation. And as Governor Harriman said, ceilings on rent don't bring roofs overhead, in his message to the legislature. Rent control is a hold-the-line operation in which it causes all sorts of disruptions. It causes animosity between the tenant and the landlord. It causes all sorts of evasions by the landlord. It causes all sorts of frustrations, disrepair. There are many things that are wrong with rent control, and yet you can't repeal it in an emergency because it is a hold-the-line operation. And I have always felt that rent control and housing ought to be put in the same agency. Instead of having rent control administered by one agency and having the Urban Renewal Agency tear down housing, well, the Public Housing Agency is also tearing down housing, that what we really ought to realize is that the housing problem is a unitary problem, and that rent control ultimately should be eliminated so that people would have a greater feeling of choice, so that they're not beholden to their landlords, and so that their only recourse is not the rent administrator. The only way to do this is to create more vacancies. To create more vacancies, what you have to do is to have a multiple type of housing program which builds predominantly on vacant land or underdeveloped land, and which also would give subsidies to the family in higher income projects and cooperative projects, and will stop demolition except where absolutely necessary. When you've created a 5% vacancy and the poor people can then have a freedom of choice and their rents can go down instead of constantly up as they do under rent control, even though it holds the line, then I think you repeal rent control. In other words, I've considered rent control as as a necessary evil with all sorts of mischiefs, which must be gotten rid of by correlative policy aimed not at minimizing the housing supply or holding it constant, but increasing the housing supply by every means possible, and then eliminating controls so that you could have a free market for tenants.
Since there is an anti-discrimination law in housing, how do the landlords get away with keeping apartment houses all white?
I think that that's a question that's a little loaded for this reason. In the first place, with all the vacancies that you have in the upper income group, I don't think there's any question about the fact that if a Negro, just as any white family, wants to move into any of those apartments, that he can move in. And that if a landlord doesn't take him, that either the city agency or the state agency, there are two agencies functioning in this, would immediately bring the landlord to book. In other words, I don't think there's any discrimination in housing where there are vacancies. I wouldn't say there isn't any discrimination. I think that the Negro who wants to pay those rents, which the white family is paying, would find no difficulty getting in. As far as rent-controlled apartments are concerned in New York, I assume that this is aimed at New York City, it's much more difficult in these rent-controlled apartments, first of all, because they've been long occupied by white tenants, long before the anti-discrimination law was passed. That in many cases, some of the white tenants sublet to other white tenants. And that there are very few vacancies that occur when these apartments, occupied mostly by whites, are bargains. So that I think as long as you have a housing shortage, you have to have a continuing pattern of white occupancy in some of these buildings. Moreover, if a landlord gets a vacant apartment in one of these rent-controlled apartments that are 40% under market, he probably can get 50 or 100 applicants for it. And it's not always discrimination on account of race that prevents him, that keeps him from renting to the Negro. It's just the fact that there's such a heavy demand due to the fact that we have a housing famine in this city in the low-income categories.
What is being done to prevent landlords charging high rents and then permitting several families to live in an apartment in the ghetto?
Well, theoretically, of course, you can throw the families out. They're overcrowding. Maybe one of them is squatting. This has happened in New York City. This is also one of those very complicated questions. A landlord charging high rents. He has a right to charge whatever rent he can get, provided it's not controlled. If it's controlled, he's charging a rent which is probably based to a previous level, which is not necessarily a high rent. If, however, it's free of controls, it could be a high rent. The only thing you can do is incorporate that apartment into rent control, though it wasn't rent controlled before. I don't know whether that would be wise. There are landlords who are crowding families in and charging them what the traffic will bear. In many cases, they're violating the law. In some cases, the properties are rent-controlled and the rent administrator has the right to reduce the rents to as little as $1. I've done that when I was rent administrator and the landlords failed to make repairs or they were violating the law. If these apartments in which high rents are being charged, the rent-controlled, you can do a lot of things. You can compel the landlord to repair. You can compel the landlord to cut the rent. You can compel the landlord to comply with the law. I can see certain situations here where people are crowded where I wouldn't want to do anything about putting these tenants out simply because they were crowded. Because if you put them out, they'd have to pay either more rents, which would leave them not enough to take care of their necessities, or they would move into even more crowded quarters. You see, you can't solve these questions perfectly when you have a housing shortage. You've just got to increase the housing supply, and then all of these nice questions will answer themselves.
I think three persons in our audience must have thought that you were a personal friend of FDR's, because we had three questions that run something like this. FDR was a liberal. Why did he not enforce anti-discrimination laws in the FHA when he was alive, when he was president? Why didn't he enforce it? Did you know him that well?
No, I knew many people in his administration. It's a little complex. What happened was that when the government first got into the real estate business, the National Association of Real Estate Boards practically put all of their people into the administration. Herbert Nelson testified that that over 100 of members of the National Association of Real Estate Boards went into FHA and other agencies. That was one reason. Then, for a time, nobody actually raised this question. People took it for granted. I've never seen a situation in my life where a national ethic, went completely downward, and none of the reformers ever brought the situation up. It was never, as far as I know, mentioned on a Senate floor. Everybody just took it for granted. I examined the real estate texts at the time, and some of our most moral realtors at the time advocated discrimination. The courts of the 12 states upheld racial restrictive covenants and used judicial power to enforce them. There wasn't one case that held otherwise. I mean, you know, it's very hard for a generation that now accepts a changed climate of opinion to realize the indifference in a previous generation. When I first found this restrictive covenant against Jews, I was shocked. I said, how can anybody do this? And when I went around making speeches, they thought I was a little crazy. As far as Jews are concerned, they ought to get better treatment, of course. American Jewish Committee got excited about it. American Jewish Congress got excited about it. But as far as discrimination against Negroes and other groups are concerned, nobody got excited about it. The reason was that it was accepted. This had been built up for years, you know, even before the FHA, by subdividers and the restrictive covenants. It was just assumed that this was right and proper. And we sit here today, you see, realizing that this is reversed, and we say, how could Franklin D. Roosevelt, who was a liberal, ever do such a thing? The answer was that he accepted it because everybody else accepted it, and nobody ever raised enough hell to have him change it. And it was only when the Supreme Court, after impliedly holding the racial restrictive covenants valid 20 or 30 years before, they held it valid, and suddenly reversing themselves and writing this opinion, which was spread all over the papers, that suddenly people came to the conclusion, began to think that maybe there's something wrong with this. And suddenly everybody changes. You know, gradually everybody changes. And now we accept the fact that it's wrong to discriminate. Don't blame Franklin D. Roosevelt. He was busy. You didn't call it to his attention. Those of you who are on hand, the public was indifferent. And the public that wasn't indifferent, namely the real estate group, felt that this was right and proper, and in most cases throughout the United States, North as well as South, the courts and the liberal leaders probably went along with them.
Your last question, would you please comment on the current rent strikes in New York City?
Ooh. Well, that word rent strike, if it implies what Mayor Wagner has called a rent strike, that is refusing to pay rent, under a law which permits you not to pay rent because the landlord has failed to make repairs, I would say that's a good law. If, when you're referring to the rent strike, you're referring to the organization by one of the Harlem leaders telling people not to pay rent, I think it's a precarious kind of protest, justified on the one hand when the public is indifferent, when officialdom is indifferent, and when in great despair somebody has to take the leadership and make a demonstration of this sort and organize against landlords who refuse to make repairs or give heat simply because the city doesn't help them. The danger, of course, in rent strikes is that since nobody likes to pay rent, that this may spread to the point where those who go on a rent strike feel that it's a good thing to do. If it has epidemic qualities and reaches to the point where people just don't pay rent en masse, then I think it can have dangerous consequences. If, however, it's confined to a demonstration in a case which warrants it, then I would approve that as a demonstration. But I would also like to say that if that can be embodied into law, that is, if the tenant can be given, I don't like anybody who takes the law in his own hands. If it can be embodied into a law, and if the tenant can then withhold his rent legally where repairs are not being made, then I think that's a better way of doing it.
We have one question I see from the floor. Would you mind
No. I'll take as many as you want.
Okay.
Well, the chances are that those who, that when you get a mass rent strike or a mass sit-down or a mass refusal to pay debts, that it's conceivable that this might spread to include people who have no complaint and who shouldn't strike in the first place. In other words, while it may be justified against certain landlords, if you organize a citywide rent strike against all landlords, I think what you might be doing is simply building up a kind of form of duress which would only lose public support and which might bring to your side people who are simply taking advantage of the rent strike for the sake of opportunism. I think it's got to, if it's a demonstration, it's one thing. If it's an evil at which it's pointed, it's one thing. If, however, you try to have a citywide rent strike, I think that ultimately it'll probably prove to have more evils than it does good. Could I comment on apprentice training in the construction industry, which keeps costs up? Apprentice training, there's no question about the fact that there is discrimination, has been discrimination in certain parts of the building trades. When I was chairman of the State Commission, we did a study of the whole apprenticeship training program. One of the problems we found, it's not as easy as people think. On the point of discrimination in apprenticeship, we found this, that even where in certain building trades we were able to get the union to accept apprentices, that we had great difficulty finding Negroes who would apprentice. That was one problem. One of the reasons was that you had to take low wages during the apprenticeship period. In other cases, there was this lag. Negroes who were not trained in going into building, who were... Yeah. Well, if you're not talking about the racial aspects of apprenticeship, this has been a long question, a long disputed question. On the one hand, the labor unions feel that if they apprentice a great many people, that due to the dips and rises of the building cycle, that if you train more apprentices than can be absorbed, that many of their people will be out of work, and the union will have to give them benefits and so forth. They feel, therefore, that only a certain, as much, as many apprentices should be trained as can reasonably be absorbed by the industry. On the other hand, I think there are evils to the apprenticeship training program, to the apprentice program generally. I think any person should have the right to train. Any person should have the right to join a union if he qualifies for his work. And I don't believe, basically, in the limitation, in any limitation of any of any kind, in the right to equal opportunity. And in that sense, I think there's a limitation implicit in apprenticeship in the apprenticeship system, which limits the number of apprentices that may come into a union.
Thank you very much.